Welcome to the EU Startups Podcast. Sit back and enjoy the show hosted by Marcin Lewandowski.
Hey EU Startups, if you're running a startup like me, you have more than enough on your plate. So when a prospect asks if your company is ISO 27001 or SOC 2 compliant, you're probably thinking, how the heck are we going to do this? We don't have the time, we don't have the manpower, and we definitely don't have the know-how. That's where Sitel comes in. With our automated platform and in-house expert to manage the entire process for you, you'll get compliant super fast. Compliance has never been easier.
So if you need help with compliance, visit sitale.ai/EU startups. That's sitale.ai/EU startups for $1,000 off your first framework. Hey everyone, this is Marcin Lewandowski and you're listening to the EU Startups podcast. My guest today is Robert Hall, the tall Dutch guy who founded Vesper. Robert, welcome to the show. This is how you actually describe yourself on your website.
Thank you. Yeah, that's true. It sort of stuck around after being in the US and everyone going, who's that? Who's that tall Dutch guy? So yeah, there we go.
Yep. Robert, so let's just dive right into it then. You skipped formal education to start a company. And 3 years later, you were named Europe's top young entrepreneur. What was the holy shit moment when you knew you made the right call?
Yeah, that took a while, actually. So that was maybe like, I don't know, even maybe like 10 years later or something. It was at first, when you start, I did something that I really, really wanted to do for a long time. And then as you struggle through finding a product market fit, you sort of, you know, you start doubting yourself. There's a lot of wind coming at you. So you try and deal with it. And then slowly over time, as that first company got acquired, I realized like, no, actually, that was really great. It wasn't just something that worked for yourself, but it worked for other people. So I was really grateful for that, for those first 5 years, but it took me a while to realize.
Yeah, I can imagine. Robert, from funding Karma to, you know, Wakupa and Quest to working at Google, you've built and led companies across AI, gaming, and social networks. What's one brutal truth about launching a product that most founders don't want to hear about?
I think finding product market fit is just really, really hard. And it's definitely not something that you can take for granted, because most likely it will not find you and you will not find it. And that is just really brutal. It's the reason that most people don't last, and I don't blame them. I've been at multiple junctures myself where I'm like, wow, this is hard. And then once you do find it, it becomes this thing that you just can't let go anymore. It becomes this thing that you chase for the entirety of your career, I think, at least for me. Building something that people actually value, that they love, is just a really hard thing to do on this planet. And every single image that you have about finding it seems that it's like really obvious because of survivor bias, probably. But it is a continuous challenge. And I think that the trick is sort of finding joy in getting there, in the road taking it, and that is really where the fun is. And that's what I focus on a lot today, is that trying to find it in itself is incredibly enjoyable. And if I find it in a way that it makes other people happy, that I've provided value for someone in using my product or playing my games or just, as a team having worked together, then I think that that in itself is a reward, but it's not necessarily the goal of it. The goal of it is to just keep pushing and to also find the joy in trying to reach it, not just in having reached it. I say that, but then there's also a side of me that's like, oh man, there's nothing better than finding than truly building something that people enjoy. Oh my gosh, that's so magical, to have meant something for another person. That is, it's pretty amazing thought, I think. A pretty amazing feeling that chasing that should be worth it, should be worth the possibility of failing.
Robert, I believe that entrepreneurship is more of a lifestyle than a choice of job or a career. And, listening to you is just kind of reconfirming that? I mean, you've got to be so, like, what do you think about it? Like, you've got to be so passionate about, you know, this, what you're building. And it's not a job. I think, like, to be an entrepreneur, it's like a lifestyle choice. And, like, it comes, like, from within you.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a side of me that doesn't really like the word job that much. Mostly because, yeah, everything about my career choices have seeped into other aspects of my life, but whether it's meeting friends that way or long lasting relationships, but also in you know, building something and that just being part of your DNA. But I do have to say that there's also a side of me that sometimes feels that it is not always that obvious. You should put the work in to make it yours, right? So it's not something you're necessarily born with and this is how I'll do it and I'll do it like this for the rest of my life. It's something that you iterate through. And I'm actually the person that drives people nuts because I constantly say, hey, maybe you should start a company. And and that is, it's not for everyone, but I do believe that it could be for you if you try. And so... You know, if there's people out there who are thinking like, well, I'm not sure if that's for me because I don't exhibit those qualities. Yeah, then you should just give it a try anyway, because it can be quite satisfying to find a structure that is completely yours to build things. Having worked at a big company, I can assure you that there's a lot of fun to be had doing it on your own.
100%. I agree with that. I generally wanted to say that Dutch people, like, they're pretty entrepreneurial. I remember starting because I used to live in Amsterdam for 3 years. I did my master's there at the University of Amsterdam.
Right.
And I remember the statistics that, like, one out of three students wanted to be an entrepreneur, which is a great stat, man. Like, it's like a lot of entrepreneurial people out there.
Yeah, I mean, I sometimes, to be fairly honest, I struggle with sometimes the Dutch perspective on building anything of scale and, like, building something for a worldwide audience. The Dutch perspective is very often like, well, you know, let's see what happens, or okay, well, that might be a possibility, but not for you. And that was certainly, like, a big part of my initial career as an entrepreneur, was a lot of that pushback. And then having moved to the US, you're competing with other startup founders at these pitch events, and you're like, oh my gosh, I'm not thinking big enough. Like, yeah. I need to completely change my mental model here. But that being said, I love you saying this, because I do think that maybe that's the Dutch person in me trying to belittle our approach to it. I do feel that I see a lot of Dutch founders on a worldwide scale, raising funding, building things that matter. Doing great. Like, you know, the CTO of Amazon is a Dutchman. He's fantastic. And this is one of the major examples. So there is a sense of national pride there a little bit, but we can't say that out loud, because that would be too Dutch. That would be anti-Dutch.
All right. Makes sense. Robert, so AI is blowing up right now. What's the one opportunity in AI that still feels like an untapped gold mine?
For me, that's ethical AI. I work with a lot of creators that help us create games by them writing a story, and then we translate that into a 3D world with characters and locations that match their narrative. And that narrative comes from them. We don't generate that. We've chosen from the beginning not to generate any art and not to generate any writing, but we use AI as a sort of natural language processing to turn their story into building blocks. Building blocks that we all make in-house. And they, a creator currently, whether they're in Hollywood or they're in London or they're anywhere on this planet, they feel threatened by this AI, even though they produce narratives and they produce stories that AI cannot at this point. Mm-hmm. Or at the very least, they have the fans. Fans are gravitating around these creators. And so we as an industry then also need to make sure that we apply AI in the right setting. And we need to be accountable for the data it's trained on. And I think that's currently what's lacking, that transparency. There are some movements in that direction. One of them, for instance, is a data set called Common Corpus that I think has a lot of promise, which is based on non-copyrighted material. But there's also this initiative called Fairly Trained, which is which sets out to basically say, hey, we want a fairly trained data set to train our AI on. And I think those are great steps in the right direction, but we haven't heard enough of that. And when you see the discussion out there going like, well, you know, you can't train on just non-copyrighted data, that's been proven inaccurate now. And with recent developments in AI becoming more less resource intensive, I think we could really do some good there if we just take ethical AI more seriously. Mm-hmm. And you know, us being at the forefront of it with Vesper, we want to invest in that. So we're doing our research, we're doing our diligence, and we're constantly trying to connect with others in the space that are trying to do the same.
Nice. Robert, you mentioned that Vesper lets anyone create a video game just by writing a story. If a teenage Robert had this tech, what kind of game would he build?
Yeah, this is sort of made for teenage Robert, I think, because, you know, at the start of Vesper, I was thinking about this time where in high school, I was playing Half-Life for the first time and, you know, it was so story heavy and I was trying to write a story myself that I could maybe publish as a Half-Life mod, but then, you know, try and publish a Half-Life mod. It's like something, it's something out of, you know, it takes years to study it. It was definitely not within my capabilities then. And so for me to be able to write a story back then and to turn it into a virtual world that I could send to others and have them experience that world through my lens, I would have loved to do that. So, you know, in that sense, this is absolutely made for teenage Robert. Right now, we're working with creators that already have a fan following, that have an established base of fans. And that's really for us a way to build up our community as well. But the longer term is that Vesper empowers anyone to build a video game. And, you know, I think in a few years, we can get there.
Amazing. Robert, so actually speaking of creators and people that you're empowering, you're giving people superpowers to create entire game worlds with just words. What's the craziest thing someone has made with Vesper so far?
I think the diversity of the stories was pretty crazy to me. So in a sense that, you know, the individual stories range from a sort of Game of Thrones type of story, which is raw and has, you know, very serious themes. And then the other one is a story about a frog and they're trying to defend their town from a heron and, you know, trying to find their friends and got lost. And it's just a really touching, really, really quirky little story written by one of our creators, Ross Bryant. And I, every time I read that, I'm like, oh, this is so good. This is so great. And I can see how people would latch on to that. So it's really the different approaches to the story. Another one is Chromogy by one of our creators, Elisa Pearl, that, you know, is both about in a sort of Harry Potter-esque type of magical university, but also deals with some very adult themes as the background. So I think that to me is exactly what we wanted to do with Vesper. We wanted to surface stories that have never been told before and give them a new medium. And I hope we can keep pushing the envelope there in the future as well.
Amazing. I love it. Let's change the topic for a second, Robert. So you've been on both sides as an investor and a founder. What's the biggest mistake early stage startups make when pitching AI-driven products?
Yeah, the most AI pitches I get are about solving every single problem. And that is not just necessarily a problem that only AI startups have, but it is sort of magnified through that lens where who are you doing this for exactly? Because you're not going to be able to reach everyone. If you have an agent that solves every single problem for enterprise, that is not a startup. That is just a technical innovation that could maybe become a startup. But like, what exact problem are you trying to hit? Does it work for HR? Does it help me with sales? Does it help me with security? And I see most successes picking a use case. And so if you don't, you know, figure that out first, then you don't know your go-to-market, you don't really know your end goal here. I know that with most general use LLMs, it becomes really, really easy for you to tackle a large problem, but that doesn't mean that in itself is a valid strategy for a business. As a matter of fact, the more niche you can start, the better, which is also the reason that, for instance, with Vesper, we chose to focus on specific type of creators first that You know, for instance, tell a lot of fantasy, medieval fantasy type of stories, and that are, you know, want to build narrative games. We'll probably broaden that later on, but this is our way to start. This is our way to go to market. It's a market where not a lot of people are paying attention, which is great for us, but it is a market where there's a lot of spent, like a lot of dollars spent. And that's fantastic. So, you know, with most of those pitches, that's as an investor, that's what I look for. How have you identified the market? If you are the market, tell me about it. Tell me about the struggles that you have. And, you know, how specific can you be? Because having an LLM at your back doesn't give you the excuse not to focus.
Yeah. Robert, you've been through Y Combinator, launched companies from Amsterdam to Silicon Valley and backed some killer startups that redefined markets. What's one mindset shift that separates, you know, the best founders from the rest, no matter where they come from?
So the startups I've worked with that seem to always sort of have a cumulative effect of improvement are the ones that are with disciplined founders. So they're the ones who send you regular investor updates. They're the ones who have a very structured process for when they raise funding. Like, here's 2 weeks. This is who I'm going to talk to. They're on time to meetings there. And not that that's so important to be like, you know, if you're 1 minute late, I'm not going to hold it against you. But there's just a discipline that comes with most of them that I model myself after as well. Like, I'm saying, like, there's not a lot of things I'm the best at, but I'm pretty good at a repeating process where I know how to iterate, how to test my assumptions, how to fail very quickly with the smallest amount of effort possible so that I can try it again and maybe, you know, succeed this time. And that sort of iteration loop comes through discipline, has to come through that. And so the founder that doesn't update me in a while and then says, hey, it's not going well. Yeah, I mean, you know, that's not the best thing to hear. I would love for me to receive updates from you, for instance, like, hey, it's not going well, and here's what's happening. Or, you know, maybe I could have helped you or that kind of stuff. And as a founder, I think you also help your team by having that discipline, right? Like, and for them not to worry, to just be precise in what you do and be clear and transparent in what you do. And that, you know, that doesn't mean you have to be predictable. It just means that you iterate through it to find the best solution for your customer or player or user.
Gotcha. Robert, if you had to start from scratch today, no connections, no funding, what's the first thing you would do to build something big again?
Yeah. So when I started, I really didn't have any network, or I didn't have any craft, and I had to build those from the ground up. So if I would start again, I would have had to build those two things. So the network you build through relationships, really, right? We are in an industry where my email address is on my website. You can email me and it's fine. I'll read it. And it might take me a while to reply, but I will reply. I have this rule where I'm like, yeah, if someone emails me through my website, I'm replying. Crap, I've invited a ton of emails right now. but it's fine. Please email me. And then, yeah, I mean, that's not true for me. It's true for like a lot of people, right? In terms of network, I think there's always a way where at least you can ask for feedback and then ask for introductions and sort of build your network based on that. One of my mentors, Boris, also taught me to always give away my time to someone in a sense of like, who knows what will happen when it comes back to you one day. And that really allowed me to build.
Boris from the Next Web.
Yeah, correct. Yeah. Boris was one of my first investors. Yeah. And then, you know, second, the craft. I think a lot of early stage founders, they think that network is everything, but actually being able to build, and that sometimes means teaching yourself how to code, but it can also mean being a designer sometimes, or being a great product manager, or a marketing manager, or a salesperson. Like, do it yourself, because then you'll have the ability to tell others in your team how to do it. And to build that craft when you're young and you have no experience is so valuable for the rest of your life. It definitely allowed me, even at Vesper, to say, hey, actually, you know, I've done sales. I've done these things before. And when we go out and talk to creators, I know how to present myself. I know how to make it easy for them. I know how to do those contracts. I can get that done. And that's because, you know, I took time to teach myself sales in my first company when I had to sell to huge companies, enterprise companies. So there's some transferable skills in that. And I think focusing on that craft from day one is what a lot of people tell you not to do. Hey, you should go on stages and talk about your sure, you know, do that. But also spend like, you know, 5 days and nights locked in your room trying to figure out how this like CSS effect works or like how does JavaScript actually work. Like there were times where I've invested in that and now it allows me to, for instance, have more empathy with my engineers when they say, hey, you might not want to press on this because it's actually really hard to do. And I'm like, ah, gotcha. I know how this works now. Or for instance, you know, focusing in that sense allows me to, to sort of have empathy for an engineer that has to also try and find that focus mode. So I think, that's how you create empathy by really, you know, building your own craft.
I love it. I love this angle. Robert, this is going to be the last one. Fast forward 5 years. What's the dream scenario for Vesper? Like, what's the most mind-blowing thing someone could create with it?
Yeah, we really started Vesper because we wanted everyone to be able to use the medium of games. And that's not currently the case. If you want to start a podcast, you can do that really easily. If you want to shoot some video, you can do that on your phone and you can upload it anywhere. If you want to start a newsletter, that's super easy. But try and build a video game, right? It'll take you years. It'll take a multidisciplinary team of artists and audio engineers and et cetera. So the medium of video games is not accessible, and that's also because it's an interactive medium. But, you know, once with Vesper, if we do it right, I think there's real opportunity here to open that medium to more people. And that basically means that you've invented a new storytelling medium that's more available and more accessible. And I would love, if I look 5 years into the future, I would love for anyone to show up to a birthday party with a video game for whoever's birthday it is, or to, you know, like make a game for Christmas about your life experiences this year, right? Like those are things that are hard to do unless you know how to code. And with Vesper, you don't need to know how to code. You just need to know how to write a good story. And if that's really a future that we can build, then that means that we've added a layer to storytelling, which is interactivity, that has previously not been accessible to people. And that's really what drives me every single day.
I love it. This is amazing. I can't wait for myself to actually build a game and give it to someone as a gift for birthday or Christmas, or for my daughter to do the same. Robert, thank you so much for taking the time and joining me on the show. It's been an absolute pleasure. And I hope to see you soon in Barcelona or in Amsterdam. And I'll talk to you soon. Thanks so much.
Absolutely. Thank you.